Howdy. Thanks tons for downloading volume 240 in the never-ending Zeke's Gallery series of podcasts. Carmen Starnino does a wonderful job of introducing both Asa Boxer and Anita Leahy, so I think I'm just going to shut up.
I've learned that there's no quicker or more devastating way to reveal a poet's bad ear than to have them write prose. The creative license that contemporary poetry gives you to sort of ignore things like syntax, grammar, logic, or the things you absolutely need to hold together a paragraph, for instance, a sentence. A sentence is a very specific thing. Either you understand that or you don't. And Anita understands that. I say this because I've actually not only edited Anita's first book, but I've been the editor at Maisonneuve magazine for her last three pieces for the magazine. And Anita writes excellent prose. I'm not talking fiction. I'm talking belletristic literary journalism. She writes well-shaped sentences. She understands what a vivid verb can do. She believes in adjectives, drops them in at the precise moment for maximum effect. In the end, it becomes hard for me to completely trust a poet until I know that they can write well in other genres. And it's no surprise then that in the Signal series, a lot of our poets, if not all of them, are quite accomplished writers for other sorts of books. Asa as well has written an excellent piece for Maisonneuve magazine. So that's been one of my litmus tests, both for the poets that we publish and for the poets that I myself read. I try to seek out the other writings that they've done to see if there's someone I can completely be susceptible to. And I've included with the book, there is issue of the latest issue of Maisonneuve magazine in the back where Anita Leahy's recent piece appears. Coincidentally enough, it's a piece on clothespins, sort of the new innovation that'll be introduced into sort of the clothespin industry. And the first section of her book actually deals with laundry. So if you want to test what I already know, which is that she is an excellent poet, that this is a fine first book, and she writes exquisite prose, that please buy the book and you'll get a free copy of the Maisonneuve issue that she's in. Anita has won lots of prizes for her poetry. She's been published everywhere and is much admired both by other poets and also the poets that she publishes. She's editor of ARC magazine in Ottawa and is doing, I think, a terrific job there. I'm very pleased to have her in the series, and I want to invite her up to read some poems from her book. Anita Leahy.
Thanks, that was very nice. Now you all know how completely obsessed with clotheslines and such that I am. Asa, you read that poem so well. I was wondering if you just wanted to take over. You could just read the ones that are marked. So we're going to be doing some laundry and some fish, more fish, and a little bit of death. Anyway, so I'm going to start with the first poem in the book, which Carmen will not want me to tell you is based on a painting. It's a little private debate of ours, ongoing. This is based on a painting by Alex Colville. The painting is called Woman at Clothesline, as is the poem. Strap sandals lift the lady above the lawn. Hung linens adopt her hippie contours. This is no Steamy Tide commercial. Our star is absorbed in cooler, wetter realities. She wears a blue dress, white scarf. Her mouth twitches wryly into some future. What rustles toward her through the October yard? Consider recklessness, how it breeds in safe places. Was laundry ever just a chore? Hold a rinsed blouse to your face. Gaze through its weave at the gauzy world. Notice how whiteness drinks itself blue, agitates the fallen red leaves. Those blankets have been under your skin. They have things to tell you, gray, woolly things. She lugs them out to air their moth-eaten souls. How gracefully she hoists her basket, all her disappointments. It's clear from her eyes, the absence of pins. Nothing here will blow away. When I was writing that article for Maisonneuve, I actually talked to this man in Vermont who runs this website that advocates for the use of clotheslines against all of this. There's sort of this movement of like communities to ban clotheslines because they're unsightly, and he claimed to like always dry his clothes out on the line but to never bother with clothespins because part of his whole thing is that it's efficient and actually bothering with the pins makes it like this, it takes too long, so you just like chuck them anyway. The absence of pins thing reminded me of that guy. It's pretty. And he has parents who have this summer home somewhere in New England where they're not supposed to have a clothesline, so they have constructed this trellis thing that hides their laundry, so they have this illegal clothesline. Anyway, I thought it was great. So on that note, which like there actually also is a neighborhood in Ottawa that used to be its own city, Kanata, where they used to have a bylaw that banned clotheslines. And when they amalgamated, there was this whole thing to harmonize the bylaws. And so Kanata lost that one, and there was this big to-do, like, anyway. The former mayor was at City Hall saying, like, we went through all this expense to hide the hydro lines, and now you're going to let people have clotheslines. Anyway. So this poem is called Things That Might Prevent You From Hanging. The clothes out to dry. Sore arms. A shortage of pegs. High winds. Underwear trimmed with lace. A snapped line. That feeling of unease that arises when you see acrylic sleeves. Yesterday, they held your own arms, emaciated, unable to contain their nervousness. Mud. An absence of nostalgia in your veins. You are shy and under 5 feet. Tattered underwear, waistbands drawling. Bylaws that forbid colorful displays of household chores. Fear of stiff joints, fatigue, nightmares of being dismembered. An addiction to the feathery smell of fabric softener. Airborne pollution, orange clinging to cotton. Drizzle. Some misunderstanding with Sabine, your cat. Lightning, laziness, an automatic dryer in the basement, age, a lost button. You believe in the roundness of the planet, but don't trust it. The Wham decal on that t-shirt you wear only beneath other clothes. Freezing rain. Nightmares about boys stealing your clothes off the rock while you swim in the limestone quarry at Hagersville. Sunburn. An unwillingness to venture outdoors. You are nude, all your clothing in the wash. A broken pulley, squirrels, an inability to appreciate old-fashioned labor. You eat corn chips and salsa on Mondays. You hate to see the faithful upended in one long row, fluids rushing, airheads pounding. It makes you want to cry. I'm not gonna totally overkill in the laundry. I have two more laundry things I'll read. The first one is the title poem. It's called Out to Dry in Cape Breton. Nan hesitates at the window, fingering lace, humming her quiet history, cut off breast. She stares down the old gray laundry line out back, up the hill, swinging low, strong as ever. No use for a body living on memories and bingo, sweetened carnations in her tea. Can't get up there no more, she says. The dryer crackles. Crocheted slippers lose themselves over and over, drones in a cyclone. Her bones fret in their thin socks, waiting. I take the camera with me. My eyes disrobe the island, gathering bodiless material, hungry sleeves at white point. Leggy denim flirting with daisies by a Lewisburg B&B. She's dying, I implore. Whispers slip through buttonholes, hems. In Albert's Bridge, bath towels drop their pink jaws. Trees lean in to feel tenderness seep into fog. A local asks of me, my camera, you don't have clotheslines in Ontario? Damn mist on the lens. Some things take days to dry. Nan's tea-stained nightie, sock feet on torn linoleum, milky breath on glass. All that dampness, dreaming static. The line out back, sighing, tied fast to its posts. This one is based on a very homogeneous clothesline that was hung in my yard once. And it's called Why Your White Tube Socks Are Holy, with an E in the holy. Anyway. Why Your White Tube Socks Are Holy. You choose which side covers the heel, always the same. Humming, unrolling their ribbed necks along your calves before you run. Out the door, down the porch, the walk, the road, the path that takes you away from my loving grip. These brief, sweaty escapes. If only you'd come back with songs and famished lips. I button my expectations quietly over your chest. You know what I like. Blues and Billie Holiday. Your voice let loose. Wrung socks on the line, squirming to hear. Hold still. Let the music run through your shredding heels. Listen for when you don't need me. Your ballads, you're filling me partly. All that is run down, trailing off key. Thank God you know how to sing. Shut me up. Close my eyes as you touch your voice to the sky. And now for a little death. I have a few poems in here that are related to war art. And I'm just going to read one of them, which might be the most depressing. It's also based on a painting by Alex Colville, which he made shortly after being led into one of the concentration camps right after it was, the people were freed. And I read some journals of his about this experience and how you become numbed to basically seeing pits of dead bodies, because there's only so long you can feel the shock of something like that. And it's pretty, and anyway, he has this painting that's really horrific. And it's called Bodies in a Grave, Belsen, 1946. And the poem I wrote, I can't really tell you exactly why, but I did it sort of in the same rhythm and cadence and spacing or whatever of this Catholic prayer called the Nicene Creed. And it's, I don't know if I know how to say the Latin right, but it's like Ars Moriendi Creed. is the art of death, the art of dying. We believe in good death, the drapery drawn, passing on before morning unearths all that is known and unknown. We believe in one body, one grave, the anguished last thin breath, respectfully consorting round the news, palm to palm, hush to hush, wet cheek to wet cheek, besotted, afraid, obediently bending into sorrow. Mythology pumps through our veins. We decompose our way to salvation under stones propped up by the living. We lie buttoned in velvet dresses, grimly submitting to cavalries of worms, acting sacred. By whose disregard are we brutalized one by one? They were tortured, gassed, and buried. On the next day, the conscript arrived, undefended and fierce. He descended into corpse after corpse with his right hand memorizing horror. He drew four half-rotten forms into somber light, and our shame purples, distends. We believe in the comfort of skin, fed stomachs, which swell into hope. The artist's dutiful eye. The ribs of the ruined protrude and divide. They are broken, passed around. We believe in one daughter by every deathbed. We acknowledge her resolve, the tissue in her fist. We look for shifting bundles underground, the dead doing what they do. And I had this series of poems called Nine Deaths, which was like a weird, I thought it was clever, like the nine lives. And Carmen only liked three of them. So there's only three of them in the book. And they're all different numbers, so yeah, anyway. So I'm going to read you Death 3, which is called Consumption. Hunger is blue ice, a cherry fever haunting your spine. Train your wanting down to the right. Plum shadows blanket your collarbone, impress the chin. Lie where shadows have no business. Walls melt as you recede into mottled caverns. Needle arms hang, fingers threading, threading. With one yank, your hair lets go. How to urge breasts toward faith, quit this slinking along the ribs. Down cranks the mouth, cheekbones rise, flushed crags out of rubble. A blue-brown bruise hovers, your forehead waiting to land. You know your stomach better than yourself. This is need. It pulses, bluer than pain, the oldest sky. It is fruit, fish, a river refusing to freeze, your only eye. And I'm going to read some from the section that Asa read from, the Cape Breton thing at the back. I'll see how, we were talking to Simon earlier about poets flipping through about what they're going to read. But here's where I have to decide if I can read all the ones I marked. So, but I'll start with the first one, which is chapter one, in which you approach from the northwest by car over a rise. Wheels black and racing, hear that red spruce scolding. Jesus, Murphy, by, when were you last down home? The island with her prickly thighs, her pork pie mouth. She is your Aunt Mavis. She wants to know where you've been. Jesus, Murphy, by, when were you last down home? From the big stop, regard her pebbly arm, yellowed vein. She is your Aunt Mavis, wants to know where you've been, how many causeways in the world, limbs to pull you ashore. From the big stop, regard her pebbly arm, yellowed vein, dividing the faithful, departing. Pay her toll, dear, knowing how few causeways in the world, limbs to pull you ashore. sloshed right and left by tides, reeling in, divining the faithful departing. Pay her dear toll, knowing she is old, blood involved. We'll forget you're barely more than a tourist, right sloshed by tides, left reeling in your smog-bitten face, high-rise eyes. She is old blood, involved will. Forget you're barely more than a tourist in her beery seawater heart. Sorry, in her beery seawater throat. She kisses and kicks your smog-bitten face, high-rise eyes in which cities dissolve as you broach her, fiddles weeping in her beery seawater throat. She kisses and kicks you, fed up with love, those sharp little bites. Cities dissolve as you broach her, fiddles weeping, though none of your relatives play. No kitchen parties for you, fed up with love, those sharp little bites tormenting offshore. Were you better off in Ontario? Though none of your relatives play, no kitchen parties, blare across the causeway, your hearty salt reels, tormenting the shore. Were you better off? In Ontario, Aunt Mavis would be at a loss for words, boiling her tea. Blare across the causeway, your salty heart reels, wheels black and racing, hear that red spruce scolding. This is quite a dramatic thing for me to drive into Cape Breton. So, across the causeway. A lot of the... My dad grew up in Cape Breton. I've never lived there, but I spent a lot of time there. And it's like another home to me. But I'm also a bit of an outsider because I grew up in Ontario and you're from away. And I started to go... Everything kind of changed when I started to go on my own as an adult, and I sort of started to have a different experience of the place and the people I know there. And one summer I also brought a friend with me, and she'd never been there before, and that was interesting. But anyway, a lot of the poems in this section are based on that particular trip, but a sort of history of the place and seeing it both inside and outside, and not in the sort of mythological way that people see it with, you know, everyone plays the fiddle and there's music in the kitchens, and my family wasn't like that. It was a little rougher. The next poem I'm going to read is actually about touring a friend around to the local...
Sorry, that what?
Touring my friend around, like the local sites. In which you take your friend, who has never before visited Cape Breton, to the tar ponds in Sydney. It's not the whole tour, all right. She's seen the back shore, its bleary eye on Myra Bay, cheekbones scarred in calcium white. J and B were here. Heard browning ferns and newborn spruce rehash burns, theories on black flies, failing in love. Slapped that pot machine by the wharf, only commerce since Mullen's store, thick with men on vinyl chairs. Heard the yellowed weeping of Rex in the two-room museum, that famous woman's nosedive into a bog at Baleen. The fire of 76, scalping hills, leaping the road. That permed volunteer reading archival walls, taking calls so she'd know it all. The ambulance bawled this morning for Mrs. L with the water on the lungs, who refused to see her doctor when she ought. The seniors' home, its improbable lawn of white crosses. Another cemetery backing on the sea. Great Uncle Vesty, who drowned. All those infants perishing the same few years. Moke Head, where you raked mussels with your string bean uncle. Ripped threads from clutches of stone. The ballpark's fence of diamond oceans, where he played before the accident, before you knew about dark-haired heroes, their mistakes. At the tar ponds, she opens her mouth to a truth that never arrives. You want to tell her you have held the tar, rubbed its sheen. Life in steel was hard, but satisfying. As if you know. Who knows why we make such messes to feed ourselves? This is our lot. Pits of blackness, sealed in quiet pools. Unfathomable love. Weather. Fire. Endings pressing into rock. The tender, smoke-stained gums of unknowable men. I'll just read a few more. One of which, when I was there on my own after my friend left, I was out for breakfast in Sydney at this place called Jasper's, which is really the only place to go for breakfast in Sydney. There are three of them. And the lunch specials you hear on the radio in the morning, so you know what they're going to have at lunch at Jasper's today. Anyway, and I was reading the paper, the Cape Breton Post, and the big front page story was about this young couple from England who had, I'm not sure why they were in Canada, but they were on their way to Sydney, Australia, and were at the airport in Halifax, got on a plane to Sydney, wound up in Cape Breton. It was front page news. Chapter 10, in which a pair of British tourists board a propeller plane in Halifax and believe it will fly them to Australia. You read this over breakfast at Jasper's, poached eggs, brown toast, Saturday. 6 days left on the island, on your own. The lost travelers sit bag-eyed on the front page of the Cape Breton Post, patchy airport grass flattened beneath their bums. A sunny Air Canada employee propped nearby on hefty, motherly arms. Will their carelessness save her from some ordinary despair? You wish someone could hear you laugh, someone you love. The week progresses. Run, read, line the window with yellow rocks. Tell yourself, I was here. Reporters call from London, Berlin, to investigate disappointment, landing in the Sydney without the opera house. The mayor declares we have all been insulted by the BBC. The couple is seen in the Mayflower Mall, Sobeys, the lobby of the Holiday Inn. They are 19. Don't drive. You despise yourself, but keep reading. The airline employee drives them to the fortress. They shrug off our aging stone. Their country is full of it, bald, gray, and rolling out of walls. You are supposed to be mending heartache, touring back to your own wrong turn. You crave accidental deliverance. No maps, none of that agitating hope. It's no good. There's always some local to show you around. Ruin your chances of staying lost. The Brits fly home. A reporter writes, no, the flight is not to London, Ontario. Laugh softly, lonesomeness smudging your fingertips, staining your arm. And another tourist poem. Chapter 11. In which a teenage boy sings a lament to tourists at Louisbourg. His voice peers from behind curls, lit before the crowd. His face white as the arch of your foot, and as tender. The song is popular, he says, with disappointment. He'll sing it the way it was made, with boiled tears, failure of the tide receding. He shuts his eyes. You disappear. He has not yet known love. Only these notes. The words that rest upon them. Gifts he opens in his throat. The song, a farewell older than the boy. He summons a future sorrow to his tongue. Holds it there, breathing. It rises over bowed heads, a dissolving caress, all the ones you have lost. And I'll just read one more, back to fish. This is partly based on my first attempt at cleaning a fish. freshly caught. Chapter 13, in which you attempt to jig mackerel, then to cut them up in a process known as cleaning. Your job, to wipe out a school without mangling a thumb on baubles that crook and snake into fish mouths, skin, whatever lets them in. When in doubt, keep lowering your prongs. These fish aren't afraid of the dark. They'll tug when they want to come out. They rise in threes, panting through eyeballs, opaque. Your father once told you fish weren't cursed with nerves. What a creature doesn't feel, it deserves. Once a fish is on a hook, it might refuse to let go. Adopting the pose of the faithful, it hangs by one lip, deflecting light. You yank and lose hold, your flapping mouth. This facial reduction before the kill. Mackerel don't sing the blues. They bleed and pelt the thighs of the boat, its palatial gut. How ordinary, quick, this staining of the pale, this weighing of bodies, scalping of scales. Your uncle hacks through all but one before you summon the nerve to try it yourself. The blade extends from your hand. It hears a taunting. Please, come in. One cut back of the gills. Turn the knife now. Rend flesh from bone. Ease into a state of fillet. Fresh lemon sharpness, numbing your tongue. The thrown carcass intends to lie tragically on a wave, sending a skeletal moan into the sea that gave it up. Your dripping hands, a seagull drone. I just want to say a big, big thanks to Simon and Carmen and the press for publishing the book, and Stephanie for all her help, and to Asa for reading with me, and everybody for coming. Thanks.